Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Are these American Spirit ones, which you get in America, and they're supposed to be kind of vaguely organic, so I think they're actually good for, you know, one of your five.
Oh, well, that's healthy.
Pretty much. Yeah, I think so.
The organic fags, the more you smoke, the better you feel.
I think so. Well,
nine out of ten doctors recommend it.
Unfortunately, I tend to feel better on a Marlboro Light as well, so I'm not...
Oh, I haven't had a fag for breakfast for years.
I need to stop. It's stupid.
How many do you smoke a day?
Stupid. Oh, 10. You know, it's not.
I'm and
not
most of those are breakfast time, presumably.
Yeah.
Then well, the rest of the day is yours. You've thrown off the shackles of your addiction.
I do what I like. You know, and it's that stupid thing of starting at school, you know, smoking in the sixth form toilets and all that kind of thing.
And you've never taken a break. You've kept going.
No, I did. I stopped for about 6 years. And then another writer, American writer called George Pelicanos, all his fault.
Mm.
He said to me, "Oh, I just smoke when I'm on tour. I can do that. You're away from home. You buy a pack of cigarettes, and it's oh, I can do that."
But
you
then
know, 2 weeks later, I'm in the garden, in my dressing gown. Yeah, I just couldn't do it. You're a smoker, or you're not.
That's what Leonard Cohen said. I went to see Leonard Cohen talk the other day, and he's however old he is. He's 76, I think. And he says, first he said, "I'm going to smoke again when I'm 80," and then he said, actually, I'm going to smoke on tour. Exactly that. Which is, I think, partly the reason why he's never off the road. Which is great.
Maybe that's why Bob Dylan, maybe the never-ending tour is to do with nicotine habit.
Totally to do with fags. Yeah. It could be. Brilliant. This is very exciting. Mark Billingham on the podcast. I'm calling Britain's top crime writer.
Thank
and
you.
And he's here. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you very much.
You. Fraser Lurie is on the faders here.
Hello.
And that's the voice that you know and love. May well interrupt. One hopes so.
That's but Mark, look,
traditional.
Mark.
Yeah, yeah. Traditional opening to podcasts is to ask people about the kind of music that was growing up. We'll get on later on into the involvement of music in the wonderful books you write, which is fascinating, actually. But firstly, your own personal stuff. So
yeah.
Growing up at home when you were a kid, what are we listening to?
Well, I think I kind of inherited, you know, I've got no elder siblings, so I sort of inherited what my mum's second husband listened to, I guess, my stepdad when I was growing up. And he was into kind of... He's not that much older than me, actually. But there was a lot of Beatles knocking around. Elton John, sort of mid-70s, that classic run of Elton John albums.
Yeah.
You know, sort of Tumbleweed Connection through to I guess, Captain Fantastic or something. So I listened to a lot of that stuff. But especially those Beatles on cassette. Those Beatles.
Yes.
I remember vividly listening to With the Beatles on cassette. And I can just about remember them. I can remember Maxwell's Silver Hammer being played on Radio 1 as I was getting ready for school one morning. It's odd that I can...
God, was that played on Radio 1?
Yeah.
How extraordinary. So I was out last night with an old mate at a concert. We were waiting for the band to come on. And as, you know, the conversation always does at these points, there's a little lull in the conversation. And you know someone's going to mention the Beatles.
Obviously, of course they will.
It's traditional. And there's a little pause and he says, all right. He says, did the Beatles ever make any bad songs? And, of course, the answer is they made 5 bad songs, I think.
Right.
And I said, what do you think? He said, well, obviously Mr. Moonlight, which is a fair point, isn't it? Obviously,
yeah.
Which I don't think they wrote. Obviously, She's Got the Devil in Her Heart.
Mm.
obviously Maxwell Silver Hammer, which has now become absolutely, you know, isn't it?
Reviled,
it's reviled.
It?
I mean, I don't know if that's fair, but it...
Well, there aren't too many songs written about serial killers, and even the ones that are tend
to
be...
This is why you liked it, of course, I've never thought of that.
The interesting... I'll come on to something else about serial killers in a little bit, but the interesting thing is, it's a song about a serial killer, but done in this silly, sort of jocular... fashion. It's a bit odd. I'd also plump for Octopus's Garden. In fact, you know, two songs Abbey Road.
And Michelle, I think, as well.
I wouldn't agree with Devil in Her Heart, actually.
Oh, you wouldn't?
Kind of quite like that.
Okay.
But anyway, the odd thing is, I had to compile a list for some radio show of, you know, songs that meant a lot to me and records that meant a lot to me. And I realised that the first single I'd ever bought was a song called I Did What I Did for Maria by Tony Christie Amarillo fame.
Yes, Amarillo, absolutely.
And at the time, I'm sure I just liked it because it had all these kind of mariachi trumpets in it and it was all very jolly. But actually, it's a song about a guy who's about to be executed for murdering the man who murdered and raped his wife. I mean, it couldn't be a darker story.
So even the 10-year-old Bob
even then,
going, this sounds fascinating,
you know,
to me.
Attracted to darkness in some way, shape or form.
I'd never thought about that because, of course, somebody who goes on to write crime fiction would like Maxwell Silver Hammer. You know,
it's
cheeriness. It's the awful music hall cheeriness.
It is.
The old hammer's coming down upon our heads. Almost inevitable.
It is. But it's odd that I can remember that particular song on the radio. I can remember where I was sitting. I was sitting by the fire getting, you know, eating some cereal. And I can remember hearing that song on the radio. So what would I have been, 7 or something?
Yeah.
No, very peculiar. But then once I got into sort of the sixth form and stuff at school, it was prog. It was prog rock. And it's very weird.
Because I think you're almost exactly the same age as Jonathan Coe, who we had on.
And
you had the same obsession, which
is fascinating. And that rang so many bells with me when Jonathan did it. But the odd thing is, I don't know whether he talked about this, it was strange because I was passionate about it. I mean, absolutely passionate about it. And yet a little part of me felt this isn't mine somehow. Because I was a bit young, really. Kind of 1975, I'm 14. I kind of, you know...
So the alternative is glam and Bowie and...
Which I was into as well. I mean, I loved Slade and Sweet.
Yeah.
You know, I was very, very much into that T-Rex and all that kind of stuff. But suddenly, in terms of albums, it was the first album I ever bought, I can remember vividly, was In the Court of the Crimson King by King Crimson. Bought for no other reason than I liked the cover.
The cover's fantastic.
Knew nothing about it.
Yeah.
Had no idea. Then put it on, 21st Century Schizoid,
yeah,
man. And you go, come on!
Nothing!
But, you know, those are the albums that I would get home from school and I would literally lie with my head between the speakers and open the gatefold sleeve of, you know, Foxtrot or Nursery Crime or whatever it was and just immerse myself in
this. That's a brilliant image of you with the head between the speakers and the gatefold sleeve, as if you are completely enclosed in a world of Genesis.
Well, that's what it was. And you would
kind of
analyse the lyrics endlessly. And I think we talked about this at one point, but a friend of mine was reminding me the other day about that great thing you could get in the back of the NME and Melody Maker and stuff, where you could send off a stamped address envelope
with
a check for £10, all Yes lyrics explained.
Yeah, that's brilliant. It's a brilliant idea.
The bloke probably made millions.
I love the idea that people will accept that is the definitive answer.
Yeah.
You know, this is, again, the male mind, the working of the male mind. I was talking to Kate Mossman, our review editor, yesterday. She's saying it's so funny because you know, men tend to think that a record is criminally underrated, you know, and they're absolutely convinced that they're right.
Yeah.
You know, this is a brilliant record and that's a fact and it's indisputable.
Yeah,
and women kind of think, yeah, it's just my opinion. I'm sure I'm wrong. You know, I don't accept that. But I love that. I mean, prog is so largely built on the idea that there is somehow a right answer and it's, you know, and it's so male and it's so kind of collecting things and details, isn't it? And,
yeah.
And fantasy.
No, and complete. And just the covers, you know, those... The Hypnosis covers and Yes covers and the Floyd covers, and you'd sit and look at them endlessly. Oh, there's that little picture of that refers to that lyric, and
of course,
track 7, you know,
of course.
No, 7, there were never 7 tracks. What am I talking about? There were probably only 3 on the whole album.
triple album,
and it was just part of a whole thing. We, you know, myself and a small group of friends, we had these kind of long great coats and long hair, and we'd slep about in the centre of Birmingham going from record shop to record shop. And in fact, the one and only time I was done for shoplifting. And I wish it was a cool record I'd nicked. I wish it was, but unfortunately it was Bo Hansson's Lord of the Rings from a record shop in Birmingham, which I, you know, slipped into my bag. And
you were done?
I was done.
Happens when you... I mean,
it was weird.
Is it not just made to put it back, obviously?
That's exactly what... It was a very weird thing.
Collar felt.
No, because I walked into this record store and it was empty. completely empty. There's not a soul in it. And I looked around and I'm like, hello.
That's a bad day to decide to do your first shoplifting.
I slipped this
Bohemian
Lord of the Rings into, well, they were, of course. I slipped Lord of the Rings away. And as I reached for the door, kind of at the corner of my eye, I saw the door at the back of the shop open and about three big guys jump out, see that I hadn't left yet, and jump back in again. And I thought, oh, hello.
Yeah,
went back into the shop, put it back.
Oh, you did, okay.
And then they nabbed me. And of course, I realised that the whole far wall was a two-way mirror. And they'd just been watching me. It was a sting. It was some kind of honey trap. And they just said, they scared the life out of me.
Irresistible album.
Yes, they knew that somebody would want Lord of the Rings. And they said, you go into any record shop in Birmingham now. We know you are, and we've given you, we know. And I was just scared to death.
You must have been terrified.
I was, but I got, you know, I didn't get done. And it did put me off shoplifting for life. But like I say, I wish it had been a cooler album. I wish I'd been done nicking, you know, Nevermind the Bollocks or something. But no. It was Bo Hanson.
No, that is a disgrace.
Did
you have those factions? They're so tribal. I just remember that so vividly that there's the prog gang over there. I mean, Jonathan was talking about it. It was brilliant. And then you've got whatever it would be, the glam lot or the punk lot or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, did you feel that you were in some sort of particular tribe?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a very interesting time to be kind of 15, 1976.
Yeah.
And,
you know,
suddenly everything changed. But the weird thing was, people seemed to think that it would be one day you'd be listening to you know, Jethro Tull and Gong, and the very next day you'd be listening to The Damned, and everything else would have. And it wasn't like that.
No, of course
it
not.
It really was a kind of gradual thing. And I remember there would be fights over the record player in the sixth form block at school. There was a record player, and you got an hour at lunch, and there would be these battles as to who could get their record on. And, you know, when you weren't doing that, you were sitting in the corner trying to finish the Enemy crossword first. And it was a really weird... And you'd see everything. I mean, you'd go and see every concert at Birmingham Odeon, and you'd go and you'd listen to all sorts of stuff. I remember...
Who did you see?
Wishbone Ash and Rory Gallagher and Joan Armour Trading. I mean, whoever turned up at Birmingham Odeon when it cost £2.50 to go and see. And I can still remember that buzz. And it's weird because you kind of lose that, I think, when you go and you see a concert and you're in the audience before the band has started and you're looking at the little red light on the amps and you're looking at all the instruments and you're trying to figure out what the band are going to play based on what instrumentation is on the stage, and you're going, oh, well, he's got that guitar, so he's going to be playing. I mean, just sad, nerdy stuff.
Every single person listening will understand.
Oh, good.
That you're among friends. I'm still like that now.
It is exciting. It is exciting. Yeah. But, you know, then it was £2.50 and a lot more affordable.
So what about Birmingham itself? Because, I mean, you know, there's various groups came, you know, the Charlatans, Dodgy, I think, Felt... Mm-hmm. Lilac Time. This is later on, obviously, Napalm Death. Yeah. But I think Ocean Colour Scene, maybe the Neds. Maybe Pop will eat itself. But I think also, you know, back earlier, obviously Dexys and Duran, but ELO and The Move and stuff. So did Birmingham have a... I mean, I come from Fleet in Hampshire, which has absolutely no history, no culture. It has absolutely nothing to recommend it at all.
No bands at all? Nothing?
No, I don't think absolutely none.
Okay.
You know, and so, you know, when you went to the Bracknell Sports Centre to see Wishbone Ash, you know, mm-hmm. They were just a visiting act. Everyone was a visiting act. You know,
right.
there was no local heroes. You know?
There was a big scene, and I mean, when I was at school, so I was in the sixth form, UB40 broke quite big.
Oh, yeah,
and I mean, they were literally from Moseley, which is where I was from.
Yeah.
And everybody was listening to that first UB40 album, signing on. And that was a big thing. And then a bit later, we had The Beat. And there was a big thing that happened quite a lot. We had a great local radio station called BRMB, which, as far as I know, is still going. And a great DJ there called Robin Valk, who's still around. And he used to organise a thing called The Lark in the Park in Cannon Hill Park, which was kind of big outdoor concert. So you'd see all the local bands, people like Steve Gibbons' band.
Oh, yeah,
and Rainmaker and what were they called? I want to say Little Feet, but it's certainly not Little Feet.
Rainmaker.
Something Feet. And I remember seeing the Specials. I mean, I saw the Specials, you know, ended up on stage with the Specials in a weird little outdoor amphitheatre where half the audience got on stage to me. No, there were some really good gigs and really good venues, and a little club called Barbarella's where I remember seeing Graham Parker and The Rumour and all sorts of people there.
Which was the crucible of kind of the New Romantic thing, wasn't it? And eventually, was it
Barbarella? No, The Rum Runner. The Rum Runner was where Duran Duran started out and all that kind of stuff. There was a lot going on in the city. There was plenty of music to be seen. Birmingham Town Hall, the Stiff Tour, Birmingham Town Hall.
You saw that?
Yeah, and that was kind
Eric?
Of when it sort of changed.
Yeah.
Costello, Ian Dury, Reckless Eric, Nick Lowe. Jonah Louis, was he on the second one? I can't remember. Because it didn't really change for me with punk. I think it changed for me with New Wave, really. Because, I was actually a weekend punk. You know, yeah. I was the kind of kid who would, you know, wait for Friday and then put my straight jeans on. And I remember a friend and I getting beaten up, really shockingly, one night in Selly Oak in Birmingham, walking back from a party, snow on the ground, and we were attacked by two couples, by two men and two women. I remember it vividly.
For what?
For wearing straight jeans.
Well,
I can remember as we were lying on the floor getting kitchen, and that'll teach you to wear straight jeans! Bloody punks! Really, really weird. Really weird.
You've been thrashed with a handbag.
It was very hard. Two men and two women.
Well, that was provocative, wasn't it? I mean, you, in a sense, you were asking for it.
I was dressed provocatively.
Come on!
What would the judge have said? Brought it on yourself.
Yeah, exactly.
With your straight jeans. So I wasn't really a sort of a proper punk. But when I started listening, I'd listen to things like Anne Nightingale. On a Sunday, and she started playing Elvis Costello's first album and Enduri's first album.
Yeah.
And that's when I started to get sort of passionate about that scene. And then my days of prog were kind of gone, until recently. You know,
so how would you define New Wave? I can't really work it out, because I suppose I was a kid at the NME at the time, and I could never quite make the definition myself, because there was the Damned, and then there was Elvis Costello was somehow not quite punk, was it? It somehow had attached itself to this accelerated new movement and wore a skinny tie, but it wasn't really that. It was too complicated, really, wasn't it?
It was too complicated. There were keyboards.
Yeah, quite. It's like straight jeans. You know,
that kind of thing. But, I still, you know, Susie and the Banshees I was a huge fan of, and... Costello was a big turning point for me, and he's kind of remained probably the one artist through the whole of my.
So you followed him? You still follow him now? Everything he does?
Oh, completely. I'm seeing him two nights running in
brilliant
on the Songbook tour in a couple of months.
Oh, and how bad is it? I mean, you're constantly checking YouTube to see if there's any new. Yeah, okay.
Not just no, new, you old. And I got an email from a friend this morning. He did last night on American television. He did a version of Bruce Springsteen's Brilliant Disguise on
Fantastic.
The Jimmy Fallon show. So I will be watching that on YouTube when I get home. No, I am a nutter for Costello. And
so what about Costello in particular? Why?
Well, it's odd, because I actually do like his voice. I mean, I know I have big arguments with my wife about Costello, because she just hates his voice. I love his voice. I think he's just got an incredible voice. And I think, you know, people talk often about how many times Bowie reinvented himself. I mean, you know, Costello hasn't necessarily done it physically, apart from the dreadful beard years, which we won't go into.
It was shocking, wasn't it?
That was. It's the only time I've seen him be bad, actually.
Yeah.
Mighty Like a Rose tour, and he had the poncho and the big gingery beard.
And it looked like he'd slept on a park bench.
It was just
covered
odd.
In a newspaper.
It was odd. And he insisted on changing the arrangement of every song. He did that kind of Dylan thing of, I'm bored with this, so I'm going to do it as a waltz. But most of the time, he's always just blown me away. And I followed him around the country like girls used to do with teeny bands.
Town to town. So.
Well, when he was doing that songbook thing first time round back in the 80s, you would see a different show every night. I mean, absolutely you would. So I would.
This
I would
is the songbook with the big spinning wheel.
Yeah,
and,
the big wheel.
You know, you would spin it and
yeah.
Or did people call out for No.
You'd be pulled up on stage. You'd spin the wheel. And I did it. I span that wheel. I got up on stage with him.
How did you get selected?
Do you know, it's the weirdest thing. I swear this is true. This was at the Royal Court Theatre in Liverpool. And I was there with a couple of friends. And people are getting pulled out from the mosh pit, essentially, down at the front. And we're up in a circle, and I was getting grumpier and grumpier, you know, thinking, why isn't this me? Why isn't this me? And I swear to you, and I'm in the middle of a row, and there was just a tap on my shoulder. And I turned around, there's like a bouncer, like a security guard, and he just kind of wouldn't come with me. And I had a camera with me, and I gave it to my friend, and I just followed this guy down, and suddenly I'm at the side of the stage. And I remember it vividly.
This is brilliant.
He puts a kind of red stripe in my hand, no idea why, and Costello just beckoned me on stage, and I walked on stage. And Elvis said, hello, what's your name? And my voice went up about three octaves.
Fantastic.
And, Mark! And I spanned the wheel, and I got Big Tears, which is a track I've always loved, with Mick Jones of The Clash on guitar. I danced. You have to dance on stage in a thing called the Go-Go Bonus Cage. And I danced.
Throughout the entire number?
Throughout the entire number.
Just you?
And they go, but I didn't care. I'm on stage with Elvis Costello.
And how many people are watching? Is this 3,000?
Oh, you know, however many people, yeah.
Yeah. That's
so, you know, to go back to see that tour again. And in fact, a friend of mine has got a video of that, of me on stage. This comedian I knew a few years ago said,
"Is that on YouTube?"
Big Costello. No, I don't think it's on YouTube.
Could it be put?
but no. So yeah, Costello's been a real star. I just think he's the greatest singer songwriter of his generation by a country mile, and I think that's kind of unappreciated.
It the diversity of the stuff, or is it the fact that you always feel connected to him? What is it? That it's about his own life, or what aspect?
He's just a consummate songwriter. I mean, and for me, it's always been about lyrics, always, really.
You've been listening to the free feed of The Word podcast. The full album-length version is only available to subscribers to the magazine. To sign up and to hear the rest of this podcast, go to www.wordpodcast.co.uk.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.